blessed, or you have a choice of being burned in chapter 6, verse 7 and 8. He says, "For the earth which drinks in the rain, and then often comes upon it, and bears herbs useful for those by whom it is cultivated, receives blessing from God. But if it bears thorns and briars, it is rejected and near to being cursed, whose end is to be burned." So in no uncertain terms, we're talking about two different kind of people here. Those who receive the blessings that come from God and turn them into and are fruitful and are useful. Herbs are useful for things that herbs are useful for medicines, for eating. Briars have not really found a use for them really yet. They're good for catching your clothes, but that's about it. Haven't found a use for briars, and so they are fit for being burned. So these are the things that he has just stated concerning this letter to these group of individuals. Then he says in verse 9, "But brethren, we are confident, beloved, we are confident of better things concerning you." Have you been confident in something before? The writer of Hebrews, we don't know who he is exactly, because he talks about this we are confident. We don't know if it's Paul or Barnabas or Apollos. There's theories for all of them, and you can check it out and decide on your own. But we do know this book is certainly inspired. That is not questioned at all. And as you read through the Acts, or just generally skim through the book of Acts, you can see that they didn't travel alone. And you read through some of Paul's epistles, some of his letters, you'll see that he often wrote in we, or Luke would write in we. And so there were those who were with them, and they would address that they were in fact there. And so perhaps the writer of Hebrews is saying, we who are here are confident of better things concerning you. Actually, in Hebrews chapter 13, he also mentions that you pray for us. So he was not alone when this letter was being written. But is it also possible to think that by these God-breathed words, these God-inspired words, we can understand that God has confidence in you and me? Can we think that? Can we think that God has confidence in me to do the task that he has set for me in place? Has God asked anybody to do anything? The answer is obviously yes. You read through the Bible, there over and over again, there are things that have been asked of people to do, and God had confidence that they can do those things. Now, there's blessings in having confidence, right? There's blessings in confidence. We can have confidence in knowing that God has confidence in us. In Hebrews chapter 11, that we just mentioned before, that whole chapter, confidence is synonymous with is the same as faith. I can't say that word tonight. Is the same as faith. When we have confidence in God, we have faith in what he has stated. Now, I have faith that I'm going to do what he has asked me to do, says Abraham. Says the prophets that are mentioned in that chapter, no matter what others would say. No matter what others would say is socially acceptable. No matter what is better for my physical body, I will do what God has asked me to do. That's faith. That's confidence. That's confidence in God. There can be power. There can be an empowering of the self to do what has been asked of us to do when we have that faith, when we have that confidence in God. Philemon, when Paul wrote a letter to Philemon, and he wrote in chapter 1, verse 21, or just verse 21, Paul wrote to him and said, "Having confidence in your obedience, I write to you, knowing that you will do even more than I say." Paul was confident that when Onesimus would return to Philemon, Onesimus, who was a runaway slave, who had come to Paul in Rome, and Paul had taught him the gospel and he'd been baptized, Paul was confident that Philemon would receive him as a brother. I'm confident in this very thing. We can be encouraged, understanding that people have confidence in us. Moses is one who was asked to do something, and I'm not so sure he had the most confidence right off the bat when he was asked to do something. And you know what I'm talking about perhaps in Exodus chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, we see Moses' response to what God had asked him to do. Moses is in the wilderness, taking care of the sheep. Something unusual happens this particular day. A bush is on fire. Not only is it on fire, it is not being consumed. The text tells us that he approached this to see what was going on, and as he approached, God said, "Take off your shoes, your sandals, for you are on holy ground." And he did so. And God proceeds to tell him who he is, and he asked him to lead the children of Israel out of bondage. "I have seen my people." He asked him to lead them out of bondage. And Moses' response was, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh?" Now, if we back up and we see Moses' life before, Moses was one who was raised in the Pharaoh's household. He was one who knew about the customs. He was a perfect person to do this task. He'd spent 40 years learning how to herd sheep, so I'm sure he can take care of 6 million people. A herd sheep and people are a lot alike when they get in a herd. I think that's a biblical approach. So he's a perfect person. But his response to this challenge is, "Who am I? Who am I?" Have you struggled with confidence before? God has asked me to live as a Christian in the face of a society, of my friends, of people, of my peers. It asked me to do an insurmountable task. Who am I? Who am I? Moses' problem was, it wasn't about Moses, was it? It wasn't what Moses could do. It's what God could do through Moses. It's not about what you and I can do by ourselves, because we can't do it by ourselves. It's what God can do through us and use us. We have confidence and can have confidence because God has asked us to do these things. As we read through this text, the writer of Hebrews says, "We have confidence, better confidence in you concerning these things." What are these things that accompany salvation? I would like to know what those are, right? I want salvation. So I need to know what these things are that accompany salvation. If you read through the text, the first that it mentions is a labor of love. Labor of love. In verse 10, "For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love, which you have shown toward His name, and that you minister to the saints and do minister." And this passage is mirrored in 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, where Paul writes, "We give thanks to God always for you all, making mention of you in our prayers, remembering without ceasing your work of faith, labor of love, and patience of hope in our Lord Jesus Christ, in the sight of our God, our Father." Our labor of love. God is not unjust to forget the work you're doing. This phrase is coupled with the concept of work done in the kingdom, but not just work. 1 John chapter 3, verse 18 says, "My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth." So love coupled with work is real love, right? It's easy to sit here and sing a song, "Oh, how I love Jesus." But when it's coupled with work, a labor of love, that means going out and actually living like you love Jesus. That means so much more. Ladies, have you ever got little notes from your sweetie before? Said, "Oh, how I love you." That means a lot. But it means more when they actually do something, right? Sometimes. 'Tis the season for that kind of event. Words can be empty. Anybody can say, "Oh, how I love Jesus." Anybody can sing that. But it means more when it's done in a labor of love. This passage also talks about personal responsibility. He says in verse 11, "And we desire that each one of you, now this sounds familiar. I think I heard this morning. And believe it or not, David and I didn't coordinate this. But each one of you, every individual, has a personal responsibility. The classic passage is Philippians chapter 2, verse 12. "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Again, illustrates that it's not somebody else's fault that I don't come to church. It's not somebody else's fault that I don't do what I'm supposed to do. It's not somebody else's fault that I don't go to heaven. It's very plain. I mean, it's easy to try and pass the buck, and I'll be the first to do it. You know, somebody was trying to get me in trouble for the pictures that were placed up on the screen this morning, and you know, I passed it. I said, Tracy's the one that made us do it. So it's easy to try and do that. But when it comes down to the last day, when we're going to find out if you're a briar, if you're an herb, it's only your fault. It's only your fault if you don't go to heaven. It comes down to personal responsibility. So things that accompany salvation, labor of love, personal responsibility, each one of you, and diligence. In verse 11, full assurance, diligence. We desire that each one of you show diligence. Show the same diligence. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 27 states, the lazy man does not roast what he took in hunting, but diligence is a man's precious possession. Basically saying the lazy man's not gonna get anything. And he's not gonna roast anything he went hunting if he was lazy. Because if you've been hunting before, it's not for the lazy individual. You know, you gotta get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, you gotta go out there and be in the bush with the mosquitoes and that kind of stuff. It's not for all that glitz and glamour, but if you're lazy, you're not gonna get anything. And that's easy to understand. But diligence is a man's precious possession, and so much more when it concerns salvation. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 7, Paul writes, but as you abound in everything, as you abound in everything, in faith, in speech, in knowledge, in all diligence, and in your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also, in all diligence. We need to be diligent. We need to be literally eager in our accomplishing the work that is set before us. Things that accompany salvation, labor of love, personal responsibility, and diligence. It goes on to say, in full assurance of hope. And literally this means entire confidence, full confidence of hope. Throughout this passage, we have this concept of confidence. In Romans chapter 8, verses 24 and 25, Paul says, for we are saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? Basically, if you see it, what you've hoped for, it's no longer hope, it's reality. You've seen it. But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. We eagerly await. We need to have full assurance. Too many times people have been let down by hoping in earthly things. Have you ever put your hope or trust in somebody and they've let you down? It's happened. And so they associate that with promises that God has made. God's going to let me down. God's not going to follow through. But that's not the case. If you look in chapter 6, verse 17 and 18 of Hebrews, just a few verses down in chapter 6, it says, thus God determined to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it by an oath, that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have a strong consolation, who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope that is set before us. A strong consolation. It might happen. A strong consolation, that way we might flee for refuge and lay hold of hope. We need a refuge. We need hope. And we can lay hold of it. And God has said, I've promised it. I've made it so that you can have this hope. I've made it so you can have this confidence in me. Two things. I cannot lie, and I've promised on myself. So that we can lay hold of hope. Full assurance of hope. We need to imitate the strong. It's never wrong to imitate the godly. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1, it says, Paul writes, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. Which means two things. One, we've got to make sure we're imitating the right people and that they're imitating Christ. But it's nice to have an example of somebody who's doing what's right. Abraham is used in verses 13 through 15 as that example. It says, for when God made a promise to Abraham, because he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing, I will bless you, and multiply, I will multiply you. And so after he had patiently endured, he obtained the promise. It's interesting that Abraham is used. Maybe not so interesting, writing to Jewish Christians, but Abraham is a man of patience. Abraham was a man of patience. Any guess as to how many years he waited for that promised son? He was 75 when he left Haran. He was 100 when he finally got Isaac. 25 years. A promise was made. That's a lifetime for some of us. 25 years to wait on a promise, to wait on a child. But he finally came. He was patient. He persevered in faith. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, another aspect of salvation is faith. Is it impossible to please God without faith? For those who believe in Him must believe that He is a rewarder of those that diligently seek Him. Must have faith. Impossible. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6. And finally, patience. We must allow time for things to happen. Abraham had to wait 25 years. And it's harder and harder to have patience when it's so easy to have things, right? It's hard to teach patience when it's just so easy to get things. How many of you still do, well, maybe we do mail order now still with eBay. You have to wait on things to come, but they do have overnight if you're willing to pay for it. And so you can get almost immediate gratification for things. It's hard to learn patience. Abraham had to wait 25 years for something he's waited his whole life for. To have a son. Patience. Things that accompany salvation. Finally, what do I need to take home? Josh, what do I need to get from this? What do I need to take home tonight? You need to take home the aspect that there are expectations and there's confidence in our individual service to God. God has expectations of us. And He has confidence that we can complete those things. And we need to have that kind of confidence. God is saying, I've given you every reason to have confidence in me. I've sent my only son to die for you. You need to have confidence in me. I've asked you to do something. And you said you'd do it. When you became a Christian, you've taken on that role to serve God. To serve Him only. With singleness of heart and mind. We need to take from here tonight that there are expectations for our individual service and that we need to have confidence in doing those things. And we need to take from here tonight that we do not slow down, relax, retire, take a vacation from our faith and our patience in waiting in the promises of God. We can do those things with work. We can take vacations. We can retire. But not with God. We signed on for life. Yea, verily, eternity. Take from here tonight that we don't slow down, not sluggish in our service to God. The invitation song is going to be sung here in just a few minutes. And it's at that time where you can make a choice to serve God. If you want to be a part of the promises that God has promised so much to His servants, to have that better country, to have that better home, you must be baptized into Christ, Galatians chapter 3, verse 27, as those who in Acts chapter 2, on the day of Pentecost, were baptized into Christ, added to the kingdom, added to the church. You must do those things. As we learned already that you must have faith. You must believe that He is. You must believe in His Son. Tonight you have that opportunity to come forward as we stand and as we sing.